Well, I'm absolutely delighted to say that it is that time of the month again when we welcome Hayley Baker, our Cambridge 105 vet from Vets for Pets. And she has come in to the studio like a whirlwind, looking like every bit of James Herriot in the female area, because busy morning?
Busy morning.
You're looking quite frenetic. Yeah. What's been happening in the surgery?
It's just been, we're seeing a lot of grass seeds and diarrhoea at the moment.
Oh, so
two things combined make for a very smelly practice, unfortunately. But no, it's just been just very busy on consults, and we've got a lot of operations this morning and things. So just making sure that we're getting through. And as I said, you know, a few sick things in at the moment that we're looking after. Mm. But no, it's really the thing that's taking up all our time at the moment is grass seeds. That is well and truly in the season for it.
We're going to be obviously talking about holiday. And of course, if people are going camping and stuff, they're going to be encountering this sort of stuff. But grass seed is a nasty thing. I know when I had my dogs a couple of times, there was a sort of a dash to the vet, because for the animal it can be horrific. It's like someone banging a bass drum in your ear.
Absolutely, and it's the ears, one of the most common places that we see it, and they get all the way down to the bottom of the canal. And as you say, if you've ever had anything stuck in your ear, it's this horrible reverberation, and they shake their heads constantly, and it can be really quite painful. And we're seeing at least a couple a day at the moment, and it can just be very uncomfortable, and it can be quite dangerous if left, because it can migrate through the eardrum and get into the middle ear, and then that can cause all sorts of problems.
And grass seeds are nasty things because they're so sharp, aren't they? They can penetrate.
Absolutely.
Stuff.
They can go straight through in between toes is one of the most common places that we see it. So you'll notice that your dog maybe has a swelling in between their toes, and this time of year I would always get it checked out because there's a high possibility there will be a grass seed in there.
And they go in?
They go actually all the way in. So we then have to remove them, and we see them going into the armpits as well. My dog a couple of years ago had one that went into his armpit and actually migrated and came out of the top of his shoulder. So they can be really dangerous.
But so they're like little needles,
they
really?
Are exactly. They're like little bullets, we call them, as they kind of migrate through. And there are cases where they've actually migrated in kind of hairy dogs. They get caught in the coat, migrated into the tummy, and they've been found up behind a kidney before. So they really are a nightmare. So if you see any on your dog, I do advise
take them
remove
straight
them
away.
Straight away.
And regular grooming will find those.
Definitely. And if you've been out in fields after walks, I would always give a particularly the feet and the ears a check over, and just make sure, and in the armpits and groin, just to make sure that there aren't any trapped there, because even in my dog's coats are quite short at the moment, and even so I'm having to go through with the fine tooth comb and I'm still finding them. So
your labradoodles.
My labradoodles,
your labradoodles. I had a totally mad Irish setter years ago called Seamus, and he got one which connected itself to the top eyelid.
Ooh,
and it was one of those sort of sticky grass seeds that comes with all the paraphernalia that comes with it, and it got in underneath, and the vet sorted it out quite quickly.
Yeah.
But the eyes were so swollen that I actually thought that he'd lost it. It was you couldn't see the
horrible.
Eye at all.
Oh, poor thing!
Absolutely
no.
horrendous.
They can get right underneath because dogs have a third eyelid that go from the centre of the eye outwards.
That's when you know they're not well, isn't it?
If they come out on. Exactly, and they often will find grass seed stuck behind them. I even had a guinea pig with a blade of grass stuck under its eyelid the other day as well.
Ooh.
So yeah, it's all animals that seem to be affected by it. But talking of swellings, bee stings are the other thing we're seeing huge amounts of right now. At the weekends I saw four or five dogs that seem to be stung by bees or wasps, and they do seem to react more violently than humans do, and they tend to swell quite a lot.
Because some people do react and some people don't, but most animals do.
Dogs tend to seem to swell a lot more easily than humans
and
do.
The trouble is with dogs and cats, they interfere with these creatures.
Absolutely.
That's the thing. It's not like they just decide to sting them because they feel like it. You know, they're trying to bite them and all sorts of stuff.
Well, my own dog, Cass, she fell foul to that a couple of weeks ago as well. I saw her snapping after a wasp, and then about 2 hours later, all underneath her tongue and underneath her neck started swelling. And even her breathing was becoming a little bit laboured in comparison. So poor thing was in getting intravenous steroids to try and settle it all down. But she's absolutely fine now. But she won't learn. She'll go and do it again as soon as she sees another one.
Well, she knows it because she lives with a vet. She's thinking, I don't care what happens to me because I can be fixed. So there. That brings us beautifully on to holidays, because a lot of people sort of getting ready, packing up. An awful lot of people have holidays now that I said earlier in the show, glamping or camping or whatever sort of level of camping that you're going on. But the interesting thing about it is if you're taking the family pet, and why wouldn't wouldn't you? They are suddenly finding themselves in a completely different terrain, a completely different area that's unfamiliar to them. If it's a dog, they will investigate. If it's a pussycat, well, she's probably sitting there sulking on the windowsill of the caravan, thinking, why am I here, as cats do. But that is something huge to take into consideration when you're taking them away.
Definitely. And we notice that people that tend to come down on holidays are more likely to get injured just because dogs go off and explore. They climb over rocks. They're not so familiar with the terrain, so they're more likely to get their pads caught, stick their noses in things that they shouldn't do, grass eats up the nose, another really common thing we've had this week. So it is, when you're in an abnormal environment, the dog tends to explore more, so it's more likely to get itself into trouble. So it's just a case of being sensible and keeping an eye out for potential hazards.
What about taking your animals abroad? Because I know there are pet passports, and you've come to talk to us about that this morning. Take us through it stage by stage. How do we apply for a pet passport?
So it's so much easier nowadays than it used to be. You used to have a rabies vaccination after you've had a microchip, then have blood samples, send that off for analysis, make sure the levels were high enough, then you could have a passport issued. So it would take a good few months to get it sorted. Nowadays with dogs, it's a case of having a microchip implanted, then a rabies vaccination, and after 21 days, an official veterinarian, as we're called, can then issue a passport. So there are only certain vets that can do it, because you have to go on a training course with DEFRA to make sure that you've got all of the certification correct.
Well, I know you've been on there.
Unfortunately,
so what,
yes.
Certification? Obviously, it was one of your favourite things to do. What was the course like then? What did you have
so
to do?
So it basically just explains about what the regulations are, what's involved in actually issuing the paperwork, because this is a big, big problem, is that each country, the passport is very slightly different. And so if you've got someone who's come from another country and needs a passport updating, you just need to make sure that you know the ins and outs of those. But then also it was talking to us about, well, what are the risks for people taking their animals abroad? Should they be taking them to areas? You know, are they aware of the potential diseases that they could catch and that bringing back? So we try and educate people if they're saying that they're going to a particular area and we know there are maybe sandflies that can transmit a disease called Leishmania. We make sure that they get collars that will repel the sandflies and things like that. So it's just trying to educate us as vets to make sure that when people are taking animals abroad, that they're aware of the potential risks of going to an area where their dog's not been exposed to any of these diseases before.
So what does sandfly do to an animal?
So they can bite and they can transmit this disease, a parasite, and it can make them really quite sick, actually.
So you don't, and equally, of course, you don't want to be stuck abroad and then have to go and deal with a vet you don't know.
Absolutely.
And of course, all vets have sort of different rationale, presumably, abroad.
Absolutely. And there's the communication barrier. Sometimes it can be very, very difficult if you're stuck out in a country where you don't speak the language. You can't expect the vets over there that they will, unfortunately, speak English. And so it's just making sure that you're prepared for, if you did have to go to a vet, what are you going to do in those situations? But also, it's really important, because some of these diseases you can pick up abroad, but they may not show for 2-3 years sometimes. So it's very important to tell your vet in the UK if your dog is just a bit under the weather.
So it sits in the blood.
It can sit in the bloodstream, some of these parasites, and they may not come out for a number of years. So it is important to mention to your vet if you have taken them abroad previously, because that can change the potential tests that we would consider running.
A lot of people may be taking their dogs into Europe. France, of course, a very popular destination if people are camping or getting a lovely cottage somewhere or something. But I mean, dare I ask, I mean, is this Brexit business going to change the way we view taking our pets abroad, do you think? I mean, have you had any indication of that
so
yet?
So currently we don't know what the situation is and what's going to happen. I hope that it will stay as it is, because it does make it so much easier for people to be able to travel with them, and it's lovely to be able to take your dogs and your cats or your ferrets abroad with you.
Ferrets, I need to talk to you about ferrets. You've put that into the conversation very quickly.
So yes, ferrets can have passports issued for them. So there are three animals that can have passports, and it's your dogs, your cats and your ferrets.
So cats can have a passport?
Cats can have a passport too. The procedure is exactly the same for the dog. You have to have a microchip, then you have the rabies vaccination, and then after 21 days we can issue you a passport and you can leave the UK. And there's nothing else that you need to do as long as it's an EU-registered state, or there are a few listed countries, like, for example, Norway or Iceland, that aren't technically part of the EU.
But they're nice, aren't they? But they're nice. So
exactly.
We like them. Yes.
They have good disease control.
They do.
So, that's what is done going out. When you're re-entering the UK with a dog, you do have to be a bit more careful because you do have to see a vet before re-entering the UK, 1 to 5 days, to have a tapeworm treatment. And the difficult bit that I think some people don't realise is it's not the vet's responsibility in the UK or in the EU country to give you the correct things or the correct information. We issue the passports, but then it is you as the dog's owner that has to ensure that everything's correct. And it's one of the biggest things that vets are actually sued for, is misdocumentation with passports or what is deemed miscommunication, because the client feels that they weren't told enough information. But actually the legal stance is that we can issue the passports, but it's your responsibility. And luckily DEFRA have a fantastic website. If you put in pet travel scheme, it comes up with a very, very clear step-by-step guide for what you need to do for travelling inside the EU.
So if people are thinking of going camping in France in 4 weeks' time, is it too late?
No, we could just about squeeze you in for that. So right, I tell people to give a month and then you'll be absolutely fine.
Fantastic, that's very good news. Now, when I used to do a lot of travelling abroad with my band, there was always massive signage coming back into the country at the ferry ports abroad. The big rabies signs and all of that. And it's not a word you hear used very often in this country anymore. No. But I was very aware at the time that it was very much used in Europe. And I was talking about Scandinavian countries and places like that. So is that still prevalent? And what sort of measures do people have to take if there are areas where there are wild dogs?
Yep, so it is still endemic in most of Europe, but it is getting more and more under control because more and more people are vaccinating for them. For your animal, if they get bitten by a stray dog, they will have had a rabies vaccination, so they will be covered. That is the whole idea behind the rabies vaccination. But obviously, if yourself gets bitten, you need to get to a hospital straight away, regardless of what the dog is. So no, as long as you have the rabies vaccination, you should be covered for it. Though I will never say 100%, because there will always be that one in a million case that a vaccination doesn't work on. But that's the whole theory behind the rabies vaccine, is that even if your dog did get bitten by a dog carrying rabies vaccine, that it would stop it from actually picking up the disease.
So what about the quarantining thing, because that always used to be a big thing? Like, people didn't used to travel with their animals because basically when they got back into this country again, the customs and excise man would remove the animal for several weeks, and all you were allowed to do was visit through a glass door or something, which, you know, to some people would be barbaric, but actually to other people makes absolute sense, bearing in mind what that animal might have been in contact with. So do we not have quarantine anymore?
No, so not for traveling back from the EU or from listed countries. This is what the passport has basically covering now. So now we can say we know that we're covering for the tapeworm treatment, which is the echinococcus species that we're wanting to prevent coming back into the UK. And we're covering for the rabies, which is what the quarantine mainly was for. And so that's why quarantine has now been removed. There is still quarantine if you're coming from some countries from abroad where we don't know the disease status. But in the vast majority of cases nowadays, as long as there's a rabies vaccination and correct documentation, the quarantine is non-existent, which is fantastic.
And what if you're like me, one of those people that have holidayed on the Greek islands, and you see hundreds and thousands of little pussycats wandering about on the islands, all looking for food, all hanging around the restaurants and everything else, not belonging to anyone in particular, because they are an absolute plague out there, but they are very beautiful. What if you wanted to put one of those in your travel bag and bring it back? How would you import it, and can you?
So in theory, you can import them. In fact, one of our nurses went out to Corfu when she was working with my previous boss, and they'd gone out to neuter a load of stray dogs for charity, which was just such a lovely thing to do. But she fell in love with a little dog, or a rather big dog, called SpongeBob.
And SpongeBob. I wonder what that is in Greek.
So now known as Spongy. But she imported him back into the UK, and it's the same procedure. You just have to have the microchip done, the rabies vaccination, and a passport.
And they can do that over there?
They can do that over there, exactly. So each EU country has their own pet passport that they can then issue with the same sort of rules. And then it would just have been that he would have had to have had the tapeworm treatment 1 to 5 days before entering the UK, and that was it.
This is fantastic. So import them then. If they don't look very well, import them. But make sure they've got all the documentation and the jabs and everything else. Right, we will take a break to check on the travel news and we'll come back. I'm looking for a miniature first aid kit from you, something that we should always travel with in the car if we're travelling with an animal. I mean, holidays obviously is the obvious time that we're going to load them up into the car. But it's interesting because there's an awful lot of things out there that would be very useful, even in the kitchen cabinet, let alone in the car.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about that in a minute or two. Our Cambridge 105 vet, Hayley Baker, with us from Vets for Pets, and we will continue to talk about taking your animals on holiday with you and making sure that they have a good time as well as you do. But just now, let's check on that travel. From Vets for Pets, it is the one and only Hayley Baker, who always makes us feel peaceful in the studio when she comes in, because she is so frenetic and so full of work and hard work that I'm just feeling so laid back that I'm almost going to go to sleep. Hayley, we're talking about taking pets on holiday and the logistics of doing that. But like everybody, a little first aid kit is often a really good idea. And actually, generally, one in the cupboard at home for the sort of accidents that you've been describing, like bee stings and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Obviously, we need to get our animals to a vet as soon as possible. Yeah. But there are things that we can do. What should we have in that little first aid box?
Absolutely. So I would always try and have something that you could bandage a leg with if necessary. So it doesn't have to be proper bandaging material from the vets, though I'm sure most vets would be happy to supply a small thing of vet wrap or conforming material or soft band, which is what we use in our bandages, just so that if you do, for example, you're cutting your dog's nails and you make it bleed, you can just put a bandage on it just to apply a bit of pressure just for 15 minutes or so. And it may well be that that's all you need then to stop the bleeding and you don't need to worry about coming to the vets. And same thing if you're out on the walk and your dog cuts its pad, sometimes they can bleed really quite a lot quite quickly. So at least if you can get something just to put some pressure on it for, you know, as I said, 5-10 minutes to allow you then to move off and get going, that would be really handy. So you can use cotton wool. The problem with cotton wool is that it does leave lots of bits behind, but it's not the end of the world. It's better than nothing. So some sort of cotton type material is very handy for bandaging. And you can get, as I said, this vet wrap, which is kind of stretchy material that can go on the outside and that can just help compress things a little bit. So definitely I would have something that you could try and apply pressure or a
bit
of bandage on.
Especially if you're going camping or you're going a lot of beach and rock walking, that sort of stuff.
Absolutely, and that's going to be the area where you're most likely to get cuts. So that's one thing. I also would always carry a little sachet of salt. This is my thing that I do, just because if you need to, if your dog has cut its foot, you can add kind of a tablespoon of salt to a small cup of water, stick your dog's foot in it, and at least it will disinfect it for you. Because if you can get that clean as soon as it's happened, you much decrease the risk of it needing to go on antibiotics.
And salt is a magical thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Really?
It heals all sorts of ailments. So, absolutely.
So, little packets of salt.
Little packets of salt. So, yeah, even, you know, just the ones from McDonald's, that sort of thing, you know, and then they're easy to transport. And then you can just add it to some clean drinking water. And at least in that way, you can just clean wounds up if necessary, because the sooner you can give them a bit of a clean, the better. Just watch around the eyes, because it can be a bit stingy if you get it in the eyes. I also would carry a pair of tweezers. Grass seeds is one reason for that, because you can. And sometimes you can still see the ends sticking out, so you can pull them out yourselves. And it just all sorts of things. You can use them to remove ticks as well, but it's very important how you remove the ticks.
Yes, we don't want to leave half of it in there.
Exactly. So you mustn't pull. What you need to do is, with your tweezers, clamp around the body and then twist. And as you twist, you can then gently pull it out, and that is then going to stop it from having the head stuck in. There's a bit of a myth that you use Vaseline or cigarettes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. The problem with that, and this is quite disgusting, I'm afraid, but it actually makes a tick vomit. So if you put the Vaseline on them, which is designed to suffocate them or the match, it actually induces them to vomit because they go into shock. So it then increases the risk of them transmitting disease.
Nasty stuff.
So you don't want to do it that way. So pair of tweezers and then
twist the little balloon.
Twist the balloon and give it a light pull and it should come out. You can buy special tick hooks as well that are really handy. They're little green things that sit underneath the tick, and they're just a bit easier to twizzle, but rather than having to carry something extra.
And then bathe the area, obviously.
Bathe the area in a bit of salt water. Yeah. They can get really quite swollen, so you can get kind of 50 pence piece size swellings. And if they do, generally I would go see your vet, just they might need some anti-inflammatories to settle down. And there are very rare occasions where you do end up having to surgically remove the lump that's left behind. It's called a granuloma, a tick bite granuloma.
And, does it keep itself contained then?
Yes, so it does tend to stay local. But there are some diseases that they can pick up, more abroad than over here, luckily. But it is advisable to try and, if you see any ticks on your dog, get them off as soon as possible, or cat.
Antiseptic creams, because you're not, you shouldn't be using everything in the whole world on your animals that you've got in your own medicine thing. But what is safe?
So really, to be honest, I would stick with the salt water initially, just because you know that you're not going to be putting anything in there, because there are some creams that may contain things that don't agree with your animals. So you just need to be very cautious about human medications, and certainly human oral anti-inflammatories like paracetamol or ibuprofen you must not use on your dog or your cat. We do use paracetamol on dogs on occasion, but it's at a much lower dose that you would use for a human. So it's not something that we would recommend you self-dosing ever. And in fact, it can cause death in cats quite severely. It's just be very cautious about using any human ointments or that sort of thing. And if you're not sure, ring a local vet and just read out what's on the back of the packet if you can't physically get down there, but you feel that it needs something.
We covered this earlier in the summer, but for sunburn?
Yeah, absolutely. So human sun cream is absolutely fine for animals, and you want
any
to use
human
any
sun
human
cream.
Sun cream. I tend to use the children one because it's waterproof, it's brightly coloured, so it then makes my dogs look silly, but it's got a very high SPF factor, and you want to try and get the highest SPF factor because they're not going to let you reapply it every 15
minutes. I'm imagining you with your little daughter and then the two labradoodles all in a row getting all their creams put on before they go out and do their worst, basically.
Absolutely.
And of course, waterproof is very good idea, because dogs love swimming in filthy old rivers. They love going in the sea and all that sort of thing. It's all part of their holiday experience.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
And any area that is pink on your dog, you cover with sun cream. So nose, ears, even if you've got a dog that's just got thinner hair. So some of the really short-haired breed dogs like your Staffies or your Chihuahuas can have really kind of thin hair sometimes. And you can cover that area in sun cream as well. And then the little cats, it's very important, particularly their noses and the tips of their ears if they're white.
Don't I know it? Well, mine's striped, but she still manages to get a little bit of sun. It's lovely, because in the summer she actually goes slightly bald on the tops of her ears, as far as the sun's concerned. So we have to keep an eye on that. What about taking the animals for distances? Because a lot of people will travel a distance. I mean, we regularly, as you know, travel to Cornwall with our cat, and she's a seasoned traveller now. But in the early days, of course, you get car sickness. Actually, animals can quite freak out, because if they only go on holiday once a year with you and the rest of the time they're in their own garden or in their own locale, getting into a car, even just to go to the vet, is sometimes a real trial. But if you've got a long distance to travel, should you look at tranquilizers?
So we really try and avoid using them wherever possible, because a lot of the tranquilizers that were prescribed, they kind of subdue the animal but not its mind. So it means, and it's the same with fireworks, it means that it's still sensing all the fear, but it can't react in the same way. So actually it can make things worse in the long run. So what we try and advise is, if you know that you've got a big journey coming up and your dog's not used to it, that you need to start building it up over a number of months beforehand to get them used to it. We have fantastic anti-nausea medication that we can use, and we do use that quite a lot for travel sickness, and especially if it is that you're taking your animal away for a good few weeks,
it's
justifiable then to use it. But I think if your dog or your cat is not good with travelling and you're not going for a prolonged period, I would be looking at other options rather than just pushing through and hoping they're okay at the other end.
And for people that really don't want that sort of worry when they're going on holiday, it is best to sort of look out a really good kennel area for people to actually go. And I guess asking around is the answer, really, because I know that it probably seems quite frightful for somebody to leave an animal that they've just only had for a fortnight in somebody else's hands. So it's a recommendation thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we're really lucky around here. There are a lot of fantastic kennels and catcheries, actually. So we are
you allowed to recommend?
I'm not sure. I might get in trouble for that, I think. But I use several around here, and they've all been absolutely fantastic. And if they can put up with my two, then they can probably manage most.
This is good.
Most. So it is a case of just going, and a good kennels or cattery will quite happily let you go and have a look round. So if they don't, then that would be a warning sign to me. But all the ones around here are fantastic. And in fact, we booked ours in for our holiday, and they offered straight off, do we want to come and have a look around? So you
Excellent.
Know you have peace of mind then that actually they're not worried about their area. They are happy with how they run it, and they're happy for you to come and see it. And it's the same with vets practices. If you ask to go and have a look around a vet's practice, they should say yes, of course.
Well, we're going
happily.
To come and do you over in the autumn.
Absolutely.
We're going
I'm
to come and spend
this.
A whole day with you on a microphone. So you better not lose any patience that day, or there'll be trouble.
Oh, dear.
Now,
no, absolutely.
I could tell you, I will tell you, I've just got time to tell you, years and years ago, a mutual friend of ours, who was a wonderful vet at the time, I did a whole radio day with his practice.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And I was in on an operation that he was doing on this little dog, and he died. The dog died on the operating table. What was amazing, I went straight to ABBA on the music. I was playing ABBA as this dog was at, and by the time ABBA had finished singing Thank You for the Music, they had revitalised the dog, and it was back and up and running again.
Amazing.
And I will always remember watching this vet massaging this little dog, and it was as right. And then I went back a couple of weeks later to take my own dog for something, and that dog was in there, and honestly, it was so perky and everything. And it was just one of those things, just
Amazing.
One of those things. And it was, it was a strange description, it was magical to watch something. And I was thinking, oh no, I'm going to have to say, after ABBA have finished singing, I'm going to have to say, oh dear, we've, but no. And it was just a wonderful thing to watch. It was an extraordinary piece of radio, one way or another. But it was just an amazing thing. And of course, after ABBA had finished, I was able to say that we thought we'd lost him, but now it's all right again.
Absolutely.
So. I won't remind you of that because you've got a full day of surgery now.
I was about to say, I hope it will be slightly less dramatic when you come and visit us.
You'll have to show me the door if things are getting dodgy. But no, we're really looking forward to coming along with a microphone. You know, it's a day in the life of a vet, and I think that would be a lovely thing to do, to sort of let people know the other side of it, because all you ever usually get is 15 minutes with your vet. You have no idea what the rest of the day is looking like for somebody like you.
So. I think more paperwork than people expect.
I can imagine. I can, especially with you running a practice and everything like that. Right, well, we wish everybody a very happy holiday, including you, because you've obviously booked them in and everything, and we will try and get you in August sometime. We'll organise a date for that as well. But we thank you, as always, for all your good advice and everything else. And just remind us of where you are. Because I have such a lot of people clamouring to say, well, where do we go? Where do we go? Because she's lovely, isn't she?
So we have the two practices. We've got the one on Barmore Road, which is where I work, and then we've got the other one inside the Pets at Home on the Beehive Centre.
And they can all come along and they can do a bit of shopping while they're there and stock up on all those things for the holidays.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Hayley, as always, thank you very much for coming in and delighting us with your tales of the vet. And as I said, we'll look forward to busting into your area with a microphone.
Absolutely.
Hayley Baker, our Cambridge 105 vet from Vets for Pets, and she'll be back with us again next month. And, well...